Thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure to come back to Fallbrook. I can well remember when Temecula was just a little village there, basically with some 19th century buildings, one big windmill, a couple of streets, and that was it. What has happened? Explosive growth. Good to be home again in the Southland. On October 24, 1929, a day that people would later come to call Black Thursday, the Dow Jones average dropped something like 2%. Now, few people really sensed it on that day. What they were feeling was the first tremor of a coming earthquake that would last, really, the next 25 years. The Dow had actually been falling as early as September, but nobody really noticed for a while. And so 4 days went by, and on October 28, which entered history as Black Monday, the Dow plummeted 13%. On Tuesday, it fell another 12%. And then came the plunge into disaster. By July of 1932, stock prices had fallen something like 89%. And get this, they did not again reach 1929 levels until 1954. But now notice something significant here. We're going to be talking about some facts and figures as to what's happened recently, but we're going to be equating that ultimately in a spiritual setting to where we go from here. How does this plug into our understanding of end time events? So it's kind of necessary this afternoon to bring in some of the extraneous fiscal data and match it up with prophecy, and then you can begin to get a little better picture, I think, of where we're possibly headed. And notice that the real cause of the Great Depression was not that collapse of the stock market, which we simplistically always look at in old-fashioned newsreels. The real cause of the Great Depression was bank failures and a contraction of credit. Now keep that in mind as we talk about 2009. Let's talk first of all about how the credit system works. And let's assume you go to the bank and you put in a dollar. So that is now on deposit in your name. To your credit, you have a dollar in the bank. The bank is required to keep a little bit of that. Let's assume somewhere around the range of 6%, 6 cents. So of the dollar you've put in, the bank keeps 6 cents. It is now free to pass on the dollar that you have deposited with them to another bank, which again keeps about 6%. And rounding it off, we're still going to come up with pretty close to 6 cents. Which is then free to pass it on to another bank, which still keeps 6%. But do you recognize that the only real value in this whole system is the initial money you put in? Everything else from that point on is simply a pyramiding of credit. This process can therefore go on theoretically into infinity. And in some respects, in the complicated financial world of today, it just about has. So we basically begin to develop a sort of phantom money that is out there. The wealth that is out there is basically predicated on your initial deposit, and right here is the only thing of value basically left in the system as it pyramids up. So that the whole banking concept then can kind of be conceived of as an inverted pyramid with your 6 cents sitting there at the apex. Now, an inverted pyramid is inherently geometrically unstable. So what holds that thing up? What prompts this up is basically the trust and confidence of a lot of people out here who believe that it'll work. And they're holding the thing up. Their confidence in the system is basically what keeps it up. If they lose confidence, what are you likely to see? Banks will be much more reluctant to lend. Lack of readily available loan funds will then begin to impact the economy. And that begins to be the problem that you heard people talking about in solemn tones a few weeks ago back in the fall of 2008. So the system does work. It's produced an enormous amount of worldwide wealth. But if you lose it, if lenders get nervous in a system like this, what's liable to happen to the money? If this gal here suddenly begins to dislike that pyramid, she's going to take what money she has left and do what with it? Well, one thing she may do with it, the most simple answer of all, is put it under the mattress. Okay? Another thing people may do is put it into precious metal. They may think, look, here's the answer. This stuff, you know, at least I've got it in my hand and I know what it's worth. And, you know, you're looking right now at this thing, you're looking at between $800 and $900. You know, so people get tempted to do this. The only problem is that gold, you know, over time has not proved to be a particularly good investment. It has not proved to be particularly good. At its worst, what happens is that frightened people say to the U.S. government, to Uncle Sam, will you please keep my money even if I have to pay you for the privilege of keeping it safe? Now, we'll get to that in just a few minutes. This is called a flight to quality. When people begin to be afraid of the pyramiding system, they look for safety. It becomes a flight to quality. In just a few minutes, I'm going to be showing you some graphs that just suck the air out of your lungs. The flight to quality has become a graph that just spikes up almost vertical. It's just breathtaking. When this type of situation occurs, what happens? Only the very safest loans get made. Old long-term customers don't get their phone calls returned. And at its worst, frightened institutions will pay the U.S. government to take care of their money. The other thing to think about is that a situation like this, a real depression, is kind of like a chronic disease. You know, you can handle this cold I've got right now. I expect to be gone in a few days. I can handle that. Supposing it went on month after month, year after year, at a certain point, I would reach a level of intolerance. I would be desperate. I would be ready to have doctors start to do to me things I would never consider back when I thought my body would cure itself. So a long-term depression is like a chronic disease. Unlike 9/11, that's a one-day event that sears its way into our consciousness. But these things go on and on. They hurt badly. A real depression could be the thing that makes Americans begin to rethink a lot of things. Like, what's wrong with our country? It used to be good. It used to be prosperous. Our kids had a future. What's gone wrong? The next question you ask is, what's wrong with us? What's morally wrong with us? From there, it's a very short step to why is the Lord no longer taking care of America? Then you begin to see billboards that say, if my people will, you know, dot, 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 then I will heal their land. Now, in times of prosperity, those billboards appeal only to the religious right, people with a very committed agenda to things like pro-life issues. But when the average semi-religious individual starts getting hurt in the pocketbook, they begin to rediscover religion. It can be a very shallow experience. And shallow experiences typically don't work very good. And for that reason, they have to ultimately appeal to the force and power of government to make them work. And then you have a real end-time scenario. So bear in mind that right after 9/11, people lined up around the block to get to church. In our so-called secular society, people in places like New York City were lining up around the block to get to mass, to get to services, to get to church. It didn't last long because we tend to get over individual episodic crises like 9/11. When it doesn't happen again, we begin to heal. We repair psychically, we heal, and the urge to go find supernatural help begins to drift away, and we get back to the concept, hey, we're doing okay, we can manage this ourselves. Thank you, Lord, we'll call you when we need you. In a real depression, what happens is people just don't get over it because the sickness doesn't go away. Just goes on and on. But we'll get to that in a moment. We're getting ahead of our story. Now let's talk about what happened last September and how we got there. As late as 2006, the world was awash in cash. China was integrating into the global economy with one of the mightiest economic engines in the modern world. And the wealth of China has huge implications. Not all of them are economic. Some of them are military. Several years ago, I attended a military symposium down in San Diego at which top military leaders were there. It was kind of a think tank. I'd been invited years earlier by a couple of senators to join a congressional advisory group on national defense. So from time to time, I would go to these meetings. Admiral Edwards was there, still in uniform, still on active duty. He just stepped around in front of the lectern like this, without notes. Just stood there and from memory began reeling off statistics, facts and figures about the Chinese, the PRC economy, how it integrated into the world, the implications of that. His conclusion was that their ability to do force projection, that is to have a military presence far from the mainland of China, was growing at an astonishing rate. So the Chinese economy was growing very, very rapidly. So rapidly, they couldn't profitably reinvest all of their wealth in country, and so they began looking around for, attractive investments overseas. Not surprisingly, because of the strength of the U.S. economic system, they chose America. With an economy growing at 10% a year, they had to do something with their money. Well, they had so much cash to invest, they quickly bought up $900 billion worth of U.S. securities. Now, guess what? Two of the investment vehicles they chose were a couple of entities called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Until one-fifth of the entire Chinese currency reserve was invested in Freddie and Fannie bonds. Huge amount of money. Now, why would they do that? Well, in retrospect, it's pretty obvious. They weren't at all stupid in doing this thing. The U.S. housing market seemed like one of the safest places on planet Earth. At its peak, the U.S. housing market was screaming upward at the rate of 20% a year. And, of course, it was backed, the indebtedness was backed by entities like Freddie and Fannie that the U.S. government was unlikely to allow to fail. And Peking just basically assumed you can't do much better than this. The money poured in. Well, meanwhile, other economic powerhouses were joining the rush to U.S. investment. Saudi Arabia, with its huge influx of petrodollars, pumped in $800 billion of investment in U.S. securities. The Mideast as a region, the oil-rich Mideast, owns $3,500 billion. Let's try to put that on the board. That is $3,500 billion worth of U.S. securities. All right, all this money is pouring into the United States. Did I get that right, or have I missed a... I need some more zeros? All right, we'll put them up there. Does that make you happier? Okay. With this much cash pouring in, guess what Americans did? We went on a 10-year spending spree. Awash with cash, we went shopping. I'm talking houses, cars, big screen TVs, jacuzzis, new homes. Pushing consumer spending to a breathtaking 70% of all economic activity. Our consumer spending ate up almost three quarters of all of our economic activity. Now, predictably, Americans spiraled into unbelievable debt. It's easy to blame the government for all of this. They certainly, you know, have their share of the blame. But we too, as individuals, chose a good life on credit over deferred gratification, over waiting to buy something until. Until what? Until we could afford it. The result? I don't think you really want to hear the result. But here it is anyway. In 1980, household debt was 50% of our gross domestic product. That's bad enough. That much alone should ring alarm bells. But by 2006, American consumer debt was 100% of our gross domestic product. Now, I'm going to say that again. American household debt equaled our whole gross domestic product. We owed as much as our nation could produce in an entire year. Well, that was just debt finance purchasing. When you add cash purchases, it came out to the point where Americans were spending $700 billion a year more than they produced. Do you see a problem looming there? Now, much of that debt was used to buy real estate. Risky, sure. But real estate secured, isn't it? I got a deed of trust. If John and Jane don't pay off the house, I can, you know, give notice, give my 120 days notice. Within 150 days, I've had a trustee sale, the house is mine. So it's secured, secured by land. And with soaring land values, even if the borrowers default, I can always buy back in at the amount of debt owed, resell it and make money, can't I? Well, hidden within all of this nice talk was a troubling problem. Banks that own long-term mortgages, like they loan you 30 years a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage to buy a house, they've also got short-term obligations. They've got a service depositors. They've got short-term credit events to go through. And so they also need to borrow. And for years, banks borrowed heavily relative to their deposit bases. Now we're getting back to this 6 cents on the dollar thing. Banks were borrowing very, very heavily relative to the small amount of money that they had on deposits, a small portion of which they still had to retain. So borrowing heavily against their deposit bases, they poured the proceeds of those loans where? Where do you want to think they poured them into? Into the housing market. Until the proportion of mortgage-related assets in banks was 63%. In other words, all of the assets the banks had, all the loans they had outstanding, almost two-thirds of them were in housing. That's a little bit like putting most of your eggs in one basket. That works great until you trip and the basket falls or the basket develops holes in the bottom. When the eggs start dropping, all you got's an omelet. Well, meanwhile, there were clever whiz kids out there working for hedge fund operators, and they dreamed up all kinds of ways to put these profits on steroids. These transactions were so complex, I kid you not, many of the bankers who entered into them didn't fully understand what they were doing. And we're talking credit default swaps, CDOs, subprime CDOs, CPCDOs, CDOs squared. This is stuff where even veteran financial writers don't try to explain the transaction. They're so convoluted, so complicated, that even veterans in the field don't try to explain what's going on. And one financial commentator just said these things are a financial Frankenstein, the likes of which we have never seen. Derivatives. Back in 2003, Warren Buffett warned, these are weapons of financial mass destruction. But nobody was listening. After all, weren't housing prices going up? How could anybody get hurt? And the result was the global derivative market soared to $676 billion, and it shot up there like a rocket. Let me show you the graph of how that thing happened. From 2003 to 2006, here's 2003, here's 2006. the curve on the derivative market looks like that. It's just going vertical. It's going ballistic. It's going up like a rocket. It goes up 5 times in the space of 3 years. Now, the result of this spending binge that we were on was that the U.S. began to consume 80% of this planet's savings rate. Of every dollar that anybody on planet Earth saved, we were using and borrowing 80 cents of it. And we were doing it just to finance our debt. Now, this morning, I wanted to compare some of the mistakes that we made in our secular economy with the advice, the good advice we got from the writings that we have in our church as to how you properly manage money. Do you see the difference? What's Ellen White talking about? A sensible level of life, avoidance of extremes of wealth, avoidance of speculation, looking back to the basics that you know can really protect you and your family. What is that? A home, land, water, fresh air, the chance to do some work. Many poor people in our country, if they could get themselves an acre of land someplace and a chance to grow a garden, could be in better shape than they are now. So you can begin to see the extreme degree toward which greed and speculation was pushing America in what turns out to be a sadly self-destructive direction. Well, Americans had gone on this binge, mortgaging their entire gross domestic product, but the bankers were the ones who really showed us how to do it. They were the professionals. We could only mortgage 100% of our gross domestic product. The bankers went into debt to finance all these loans, and by 2007, the financial sector's debt equaled 116% of the gross domestic product, which looks like this. Here's how much our country can produce. Here's how much the banking industry is in debt. Now we're approaching a definitional insolvency. Back in 1980, banks had only owed about 21% of our gross domestic product. By 2008, they owed 116%. Well, now let's get real basic and simple. I've given you some facts and figures. Now what do we do with them? You know, what goes up must come down, huh? Newton figured that one out in the 16th or 17th century, didn't he? And by the way, Newton figured that out along with his conviction that the day of judgment was probably less than 300 years into the future, and Adventist pioneers validated that in 1844. So we have some pretty good company. Sir Isaac Newton came to the same conclusion. Now, Newton's law suggests that the higher something soars, the bigger the splash when it falls. And Americans would learn that just as autumn neared in 2008. Now, despite evidence to the contrary, economic strategists entered 2008 oddly optimistic. They still had smiles on their faces. Autumn would turn those smiles upside down. They, ignoring massive write-offs by major financial firms in the fourth quarter of 2007, economists were predicting, we're going to have 2.3% growth rate in 2008, and they put the odds of a recession at only 50%. And despite a declining Standard & Poor's index, despite a beginning of a free-falling housing market, despite the near collapse of outfits like Bear Stearns as late as April of 2008, they're still expecting positive economic growth for the year. But the system now is nearing the end of a process just as inevitable as gravity, and now natural law begins to take over. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index of housing prices in 20 cities had begun to fall in February of 2007, which means that supply is now beginning to overtake demand. Subprime home builders are beginning to find they owe more than they can sell for, and home buyers who owe more than they can sell for, many of them respond by doing what? They pack as much as they can into the car, They fill the gas tank and they just drive off and leave it. Which now brings those poignant newscast images of swimming pools turning green and hired crews carrying family mementos out of an abandoned home. You seen those on TV? Well, that's how it happened. Well, the next act in the drama was investors. They began piling on collateralized debt obligations, the mysterious CDOs that we talked about earlier, many of which were so complex the bankers themselves didn't really understand what they had done. And now enters AIG. Have you ever heard of them? All right. They began selling what are called credit default swaps. And basically, that's kind of an insurance policy. So if you buy $10,000 worth of somebody's security, but you're afraid that that security won't hold its value, you go to AIG, pay a premium, and you get what's called a credit default swap. If your security falls in value, AIG will pay you off as an insurer. And it's a wonderful profit center for the insurance company. As long as things go good, they pocket the premium, they never have to pay you scat, and it all goes nicely. By the way, do you wonder why the government let Lehman collapse with $613 billion in debt and then bailed out AIG? Well, let me explain. AIG was deeply involved in these credit swaps. As long as the economy was good, they worked. But what if the economy peaked and started down? What if the avalanche began to happen? Well, it started. Overnight, AIG had to post $14 billion, which it didn't have, which now meant that investment banks had no insurance shield. Now, they started having to write down their assets, recognizing losses in a market where capital for borrowing to cover this stuff simply wasn't available anymore. And now, for the first time, you begin to see, emerging through the fog, the blurry outlines of doomsday coming on. If they can't pay, if these banks can't pay, if AIG can't pay, what about the major players around the world who find themselves uninsured when their investments collapse? Now economists are looking at something they call systemic failure. The whole thing's coming down. Remember China, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, our big foreign lenders? If we let the system collapse, what happens to our foreign sources of credit? See, America is now surviving on the umbilical cord of foreign loans. We simply don't have the option of allowing that kind of failure that would dry up our foreign sources of credit. And so now enter worried-looking congressmen, Treasury secretaries, Fed chairmen, and the whole group. And the result is we decide to take $700 billion of non-existent taxpayer money borrowed from our very generous, unborn, great-great-grandchildren. The only problem that I see there, and I hope I'm wrong, I hope this year turns around. I hope we are becoming alarmed over nothing, and the Lord can intervene, and 2009 can turn around. I'm not saying it cannot. I'm just saying be aware of the possibilities. How does $700 billion look against a figure like that? Can you effectively throw enough money at the problem? The other question I've got to ask is this. It's borrowing that got us in this mess in the first place. How do you cure a borrowing problem with borrowing? I've yet to wrap my mind around that one. There may be a way. I may not be smart enough to see it. But what I'm saying is we do have here the ingredients of potential trouble. Well, as if on cue, the next act in the drama occurred right on schedule. Just as in 1929, banking problems led to the Depression and the stock market followed, it happened here as well. Just as in 1929, stock market goes awry, swinging from wild fear to brief moments of irrational optimism, and now the disaster starts marching home toward Main Street. Now, you got money in the stock market if you have investments there. And you see these things begin to fall like a grand piano. Suddenly, your 401k, which, by the way, is named for a section in the Internal Revenue Code, your 401k plan, or your IRA, or your Roth IRA, or your deferred benefit plan funded with company stock begin to shed value like a meteor. I mean, sending off sparks and flames as they burn off, re-entering the atmosphere of reality. People with their futures invested in the stock market suddenly realize there may be no future. And if your retirement funds were in cash, usually cash is king, but in this goofy world, you watch as a panicked Fed lowers interest rates to the point where they're almost of negative value, and now you can't afford to live like you did because your interest payments coming from your retirement funds aren't enough to live on, and bingo, the impossibles happen. The chemistry rules of economics have changed, and these two substances here, which were previously immune from corrosion, are beginning to rust. Are you following me? People ask me, where do I put my money? I respond, I haven't got the foggiest. I'm serious. I wouldn't be brave enough now to trust my future to the stock market. There may be some people who get very wealthy, very knowledgeably buying some bottom feeders and writing them up, if they ever go up. But you put your money in the bank. Have you looked at the returns you're getting these days? Barely enough to even hope to keep pace with inflation. Now, here's another problem. When government injects $700 billion, let's see if I can get it right this time. Now, that's $700 million, right? All right, when government injects that much money into the system, what typically happens? Supply and demand. The more there is of something, the less it's worth, right? Am I correct in that? In Germany, in the 20s, when they were struggling to pay off their debt from World War I, they finally resorted to printing money. They just didn't know what else to do. The mark inflated so catastrophically that finally they wouldn't print marks on both sides of the paper. It wasn't worth the ink. You would go into a restaurant and you would order and pay for your food at the start because by the time you finished dinner, the price would have gone up. There's a story of a German who went to the store to buy a loaf of bread. By this time, it took a wheelbarrow full of marks to do it. So he brought his wheelbarrow full of marks to the door of the bakery and left it out there. And his friend said, aren't you afraid somebody's going to steal that? Steal that stuff. It's not worth stealing. He was right. When he came back out with his loaf of bread, the marks were in a heap. Somebody had stolen the wheelbarrow. Now, I ran this by an economist from SC, because I was concerned when we start pumping this kind of government-generated money into the system, do we face inflationary problems? He said there are two factors to inflation. One is quantity of money, and one is velocity. In other words, how fast that money gets spent. If this stuff goes into the bank, and they're all scared to death of each other, you know, it's like a bunch of porcupines in a cage, don't touch me. So they're all huddled together, hanging on to their money, which is exactly what the government didn't want them to do with this $700 billion. But they're afraid to loan it to each other because nobody trusts anybody anymore because this thing's unstable. If they're hanging on to it and the money isn't moving fast, you're going to have a control of inflation. So we haven't seen hyperinflation yet. I hope we don't. For the sake of our country, which I love, for the sake of the work of God, which needs funds to do its job, I hope we don't see hyperinflation. But if this $700 ever accelerates and starts getting spent fast, my worry is we're going to see an inflation curve that looks an awful lot like that. Okay? So people ask me, what do you invest in? Stock market? I don't think so. Put it in the bank? Well, you know, if you want to get 1%, if you're lucky, give it to the federal government, and with the yield curve dropping to the point where it doesn't even equate inflation, you're paying the government to keep your money safe. That's real fear. So where do you put your money? Is there a possibility that lady who wrote so much and is accused of copying so much had her pen dipped in the right ink. Tell you one thing they're not taking from me is our paid-for rural home with its spring water, its good soil, and a comfortable home out in the country. I have to walk away from that at the end of time. I'm not leaving that much behind. I'm glad to leave it. But if I were tied up with an awful lot of investment here, it might be a whole lot tougher for me. So all I'm saying is that I think that we, with the blessings of the information that we've been given in the Advent movement, have a real advantage in approaching problems like this, because we ride to an astonishing extent. If we follow these principles, we ride above the storm. Now, once in a while, a thunderhead will come up there and bang you around a little bit. But you follow heaven's plan, and pretty much you're above the storm. You're above the fray, because all that stuff going on down there is not important to you. You're looking to get off this world, not to acquire a bunch of it. See, whole different perspective. All right. So the question arises then, what do you do with your money? Stock market is not predictable. Well, it's predictable. That's the sad thing. Banking doesn't provide you much of a return. The Fed may charge you to keep your money safe. So there's the problem people got to. But now the worst was yet to come. I hope I'm not putting you to sleep with all this stuff. I mean, this is not exactly what you call, you know, joyful news. But at least I'm trying to tell you what happened as clearly as I can, because we're living with this mess. If you want to know how to get out of a problem, look backwards, see where the trail led from, look ahead, see how to get it, see where the route of escape is. It's a little easier to understand and deal with, I think, if you know what went wrong. So let me tell you now the final disastrous moves that led us to the problem we face today. And while I erase this board, I might suggest it wouldn't be a bad idea to be in prayer for our country and its leadership. None of us enjoy seeing this happen. We love our country. We enjoyed the good life. I hate to see it go like this. I would much prefer to see 2009 become a year of recovery, and I'm not saying that's impossible. I'm just saying there are a lot of factors running against it that we need to seriously consider. So now the final act that occurs in this thing is deleveraging. Now let me try to figure out how to explain this to you. In an inflationary cycle, as prices go up, basically what happens is there is more demand than there is product. So the price tends to rise because a surplus of buyers are bidding for the same amount of property. When they buy in at an inflated price, that reduces the inventory, pushes the price up further. There's still more people looking for it. And so what happens here is you have an upward spiral where prices continue to rise. That's your inflationary cycle. That's where people can leverage their debts, because they borrow against a property that they figure will be worth in a couple of years much more than they owe. So what they're doing is they're leveraging into the future, taking advantage of the expected future rise in value. Does that make sense to you? That's the leveraging spiral. Okay. Well, in the financial world, an inflationary spiral, it kind of looks like that, finally reaches the end of its sustainable life. You reach a point where you just have a limit of debt that you can't sustain, you can't go beyond it. The debt is just not sustainable. When that happens, Newton's law takes over. Now it comes back down again, and we have what some economists call the deleveraging death spiral. Let me explain how it happens. Let me do it by way of example. Suppose that you're making good money, and you've always liked Bentley automobiles, as did the CEO of one of our clients. You go out and you buy a Bentley, and it's big bucks. But you enjoy it. You enjoy all of the amenities of a truly expensive car. Okay? Now let's assume you discover, as improbable as this sounds, that you can't afford the thing. You just, you finally go home, run the tape, and realize how many zeros there are after the dollar sign where you signed up to buy it, where you're in debt. The debt is not sustainable. What do you do? Well, Forrest Gump could figure that one out, right? You sell the thing. You sell your Bentley, which works okay unless all of the other neighbors on your block have said, hey, the Jones just bought a Bentley. Let's us get one too. They all get in the same mess about the same time, and they all realize we can't afford this thing. I don't know how the Jones can afford it, but we sure can't. Let's put it on the market. And the day you put your classified ad in the newspaper, Bentley for sale, everybody else on the block has done the same thing. Suddenly you have an oversupply of Bentleys, a limited buyer pool, and so what happens is your Bentley isn't worth what you paid for it. You have to reduce the price in order to get a buyer, which further reduces the value of all of the other ones, and the thing tends to spiral down, and it becomes basically a self-feeding process, very much like a firestorm. Now, put this in the banking context. Banks, too, have to sell their assets to reduce debt. More and more assets get dumped on the market, forcing the price down, which in turn means the banks have to sell still more assets, which further depresses the price, and hence the banks have to sell still more, which further depresses on and on and on. And this thing becomes a spiral, which is exactly what is happening to real estate. The index of house prices in 20 cities began falling in February of 2007, down by June of 2008, down 16%. Some are predicting another 13% this year. Now, that's for housing prices, but for the banking community, the spiral is even worse. Bank assets have fallen 55%. Now, remember, what really caused the Great Depression was not Wall Street, but a banking collapse. With that in mind, here's the dynamic we now face. As of last fall, banks had recognized $334 billion in losses. Let's diagram this, because it'll help you understand why our world is getting a little tough. Banks had recognized $334 billion in losses. Well, that's the wrong one, isn't it? They managed to raise some money, about $225 billion, in order to, $235 billion to cover this. So they didn't raise enough money to cover their losses, and they're left here with what? $99 billion of losses they cannot cover. But remember the inverted pyramid? They have to have at least 10 times the assets that they're showing on their books, which means that this thing, they have to 99 billion times 10 equals 990 billion that they have to actually reflect on their balance sheets. And we're raising to solve everything, including the banking crisis, the automotive crisis, AIG, and so forth, $700 billion in taxpayer money. The math simply does not work. Now, suddenly, the banking system is in almost $1 trillion. The inverted pyramid begins to look vulnerable. Only this isn't 1929. This is 2009, and a lot of things have changed. Now, remember this morning we were comparing the 1930s with the present? Let's quickly take a review of that. Back in the 1930s, there was no global housing crisis. Now, China holds $1,330 billion worth of foreign reserves, most of it in the United States. Back in the 1930s, the U.S. was merchant and manufacturer to the world. We even sold pre-war steel to Japan, and much of it was scrap iron. Admiral Halsey was said to have told his fleet commanders, you get one or two good hits on an enemy ship, forget it. Put your guns on somebody else because that stuff is scrap metal. It doesn't have the tensile strength that virgin steel would have had. You put a couple of good rounds in that hull, it's going down. So we were merchants and manufacturers to the entire world. Now, try to find anything we make here anymore. For example, toys, garden hose, tools, even to a growing extent, automobiles. And let me take that one step further and say that we are shipping offshore not only our manufacturing capacity, but our service industry. For a while, we were saying America doesn't have to make anything anymore. We're a service industry provider. We provide services to the world. Now, when you call to inquire about your utility bill, or you call customer service for technical assistance on your computer, what do you hear? Good morning, this is Charlie. May I have your customer number, please? Well, you ain't talking to Charlie. His name is Sandeep, and you're not talking to Cincinnati, you're talking to Calcutta. Okay? So even the service industry, we're now moving offshore to very, very large Asian nations with very well-educated, very committed, very well-trained people who don't ask $80 an hour to build a car. They're happy to get $80 a week, maybe $80 a month. How do you compete with that? In our second session, I'm going to share with you some of my thoughts on Ellen White's interesting remarks about labor unions and how they would bring on a time of trouble such as the world has never seen. And it's happened in a way we never saw coming, and I doubt she saw it coming. She just knew it was going to happen. She said it, and a lot of people put their jobs on the line with no better reason than that she said it. And it's turned out to be right, but in a way that just totally blows my mind, because what's happened is we've had a tectonic shift of the whole world economic system as a result, primarily, of labor unions. All right, we're nearing the end of our presentation here. A lot of things have happened since 1929. Now, where does that lead us? At this stage of the game, what I think I want to do is put up on the screen some of the slides that we have. Are we able to get those up there? It'll just kind of illustrate for you the severity of the problem. The first one you see there is this a graph showing a debt supercycle at its end. Over on the left-hand side, you see 1929. You see that peak that looks kind of like Mount Everest over on your left? Then you see it dips down into the 50s, and 54 is when we recovered from the Depression. Now watch the debt climb again as you go right over to 2008, and now we're at a point that exceeds the crisis levels of 1929. Gives you a little idea of a graphic portrayal of where we are and what's happening. A lot of that has been because we've spent an awful lot in our households, more than we could afford to spend. Let's go to slide number 2, and you will see there a line that shows household debt as a percent of disposable personal income. Back in 1990, it was a little over 80%. That's on the left-hand side. As you come up to 2008, you can see it's soaring up toward 130%. And we owe Morgan Stanley, a very fine brokerage house, thanks for providing these in a CLE session that I attended, and they provided them for us. I'm sharing them with you as an educational outreach because I think Morgan Stanley's done a pretty good job of this. Slide number 3, explosion in home ownership. Take a look back there in 1965 on the left. You see how it's the housing bubble, and it operates the same way, I think, if I'm seeing it. Okay, well, then we're back one. Personal savings rate. Okay, you can see from that one how personal savings dropped from 1980 down to a point here at 2008 where we're nearing a zero mark. And you're going to see that go below zero rather soon. Okay, let's put the next slide up, and let's find out what it is. Explosion in home ownership. Okay, there we go. There you see the trend as the 1990s progressed of everybody buying a home, which is a dream everybody ought to be able to exercise. My concern is that this was done irresponsibly. People were allowed into debts they shouldn't have ever gotten into, and now they're paying the price, and their kids are, and the whole system is. Okay, let's move on to next to number four. I'm thinking, okay. Yeah, there is just another illustration of the housing bubble and how it went up and how it's coming back down. All right, next. Explosion of of subprime mortgages. These are mortgages that basically are junk bonds. People couldn't afford them from the start. They should have never been put into those kind of mortgage. And you see here in the around 2003, it just takes off almost vertically, begins to level off, and you're going to see a catastrophic decline there very soon. Next. All right, this one is called systemic crisis. Well, that's the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Need I say more? That's like riding, you know, the Viper at Magic Mountain. By the time you get to the bottom, you don't have your lunch anymore and you don't want it. Okay, let's move on. Looming global recession fears. This is volatility. This is a stock market in just a few days last fall. Look at how the thing is performing. It looks like a Mexican jumping bean. It's just all over the place. People don't know whether to buy, sell, or just run. That's volatility. That is not the sign of a stable market. Next one. Dramatic repricing of risk. Okay, here we go. On the right, you see those vertical lines. What those represent is the difference between what you get from a corporate bond and what you get from a government bond. Now, you can see back in the 90s, corporate bonds and government bonds ran fairly close together. Sometimes corporates would pay more, a little bit more. Sometimes treasuries would get very close. But look over here. The yield spread now is just tremendous. What does that tell you? People are no longer putting their faith in economic entities like corporations, corporate bonds. They're not buying them. They're taking their money to the government saying, I don't care that you only pay 0.5% a year. Keep it for me. I know it's safe. Well, let's hope it is. Next slide. Here is flight to quality. Yeah. That's the U.S. Treasury yield to maturity. Now, way back in the 1980s, you see where U.S. Treasury bonds 10 years were paying 15% at their peak? Now look what they're paying. Down around 2 or 3%. And I'm hearing that that thing, you know, when you factor in other costs, is actually equating to a negative value, so that lenders to the government, people who invest their money there, are basically taking a loss just to have it in what they conceive to be a safe place. Next slide, please. Consumer confidence at an all-time low. Your endpoint over here is 2008. There is where the average individual thinks we're headed, and you notice that there is no discernible upturn to it. All right, enough of those. Let's summarize. Would you say there is enough reason, at least, to be a little bit concerned? Panicked? No. Christians should not be panicked. This thing will bite us. It'll bite some of us. It will have bitten some of your retirement income, some of you. It will have bitten your investment income. It will bite into the money you put away for your kids' tuition under various provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, where you can indeed put money away for kids' tuition. This thing hurts. I'm not going to pretend that we're immune from getting hurt from this. But what I am saying is that to the extent that we adopt a lifestyle and investment rationale and our own personal values consistent with what we've been told for so many years the end of time would look like, we can minimize the effects of this kind of a problem. And how do you do that? You do that by recognizing our future isn't on this world. We live simply. We live as well as we can. We teach our kids and our grandkids, first and foremost, the dignity of work, the value of being self-sufficient as much as you can, the good old friendly earth that if you put a little effort into it, will produce some food for you. And I can tell you there is nothing in the world like eating food that just an hour before was growing in your garden. You'll never want to go to the supermarket again. It's a good feeling. So as we face a complex future, and as you have some just superbly credentialed people tomorrow getting practical about this and giving practical advice on what you do with your day-to-day financial issues, remember, we are not without a game plan in this Advent message. This shouldn't come as a surprise. This is just a signpost that we're moving along toward a goal all of us ultimately want to reach. And in the meantime, I think we live as well as we can, recognizing that in a war zone, life is not always as nice as we wish it were. Now, next hour, and in conclusion, we want to talk about, in practical way, the economy, implications for an end time people. Get practical about how we can spiritually relate to some of this stuff and take steps that will be of help to us in avoiding an aggravation of the problem. Okay? I think what we're going to do is take a break and then come back, or maybe the pastor will give us further instructions.